The content of this program is intended for the blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the November-December 2022 issue. We begin with our story, Targeting Typhoons. An ambitious group of Japanese scientists sees one of the country's greatest climate threats as a massive opportunity. Taiga Mitsuyuki, a marine systems engineer at Yokohama National University in Japan, holds a small plastic model in his hands. The 3D printed ship, sporting twin hulls and rigid sails mounted on an A-frame, was built to illustrate a seemingly impossible purpose. If a full-scale version of the boat is built, it could draw energy from one of nature's most destructive forces. Mitsuyuki and his colleagues have high hopes for such a vessel. The scientists want to make storm engineering a real prospect by 2050. Once deployed, these ships would enable the team to capture and store a typhoon's energy with propellers and batteries. At the same time, an accompanying drone armada would inject a cooling agent into the storm, helping to weaken it. This mission feels increasingly vital as storms hitting Japan and much of the world are intensifying. While the relationship between climate change and weather is complex, scientists believe that warmer seas are fueling stronger typhoons and warmer land surfaces are attracting them, leading to more frequent landfalls. Researchers at the Japan Meteorological Agency also found that the number of tropical cyclones approaching the country's southern coast, including Tokyo, has risen dramatically over the last 40 years. The annual average number that approached Tokyo increased by more than 50% over two decades, from 1.55 cyclones between 1980 and 1999 to 2.35 between 2000 and 2019, according to a Journal of the Meteorological Society of Japan study. Beyond that, the storms are strengthening as they near land and have slowed in pace, which can render them even deadlier. That's why, to counter this growing threat, the team of Japanese scientists launched Typhoon Shot. As well as attempting to harness a storm's energy, the massive research project is dedicated to investigating whether or not it's possible to tame typhoons and mitigate the destruction often left in their wake. People have had to reckon with the raw power of Pacific storms throughout Japanese history. For instance, the infamous kamikaze suicide attack planes of World War II were named after the divine winds that were believed to have sunk invading Mongol fleets in the 13th century. More recently, the most destructive threat from the skies has come in the form of typhoons, tropical cyclones with maximum sustained winds higher than 74 miles per hour. When Typhoon Vera made landfall in September 1959, a surface central pressure of 929 hectopascals was registered, the second lowest on record. Tropical storms with lower pressure tend to be more powerful. The tide reached a height of 3.89 meters, nearly 13 feet, in the port of Nagoya on the southern coast of Honshu, Japan's main island, in a record storm surge. Typhoon Vera, known locally as Isewan, because it wreaked the most devastation on the Ise Bay region, left 5,098 people dead, 40,838 homes destroyed, and 363,611 houses flooded. It proved to be the deadliest typhoon in Japanese history. The catastrophe forced the government to not only pass an extra national budget to cover the losses and relief, but to establish a comprehensive disaster preparedness system codified in the Disaster Countermeasures Basic Act. In the decades since Vera, Japan has also built stronger coastal defenses and more resilient housing and transportation infrastructure, as well as cutting-edge communication systems. The Typhoon Shot project, however, is unlike any previous storm protection efforts the country has ever seen. In addition to sapping typhoons of their strength, the initiative also aims to harness their wind power as a form of renewable energy. With major private sector partners like Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting on board, backers are cautiously confident that the researchers can realize their plan in the next few decades. Those behind the effort promise that they can turn typhoons into a blessing by around 2050, the project's website claims. The idea behind the Typhoon Shot is based on the fact that typhoons have structures that are vulnerable, says Hironori Fudayasu, director of the Typhoon Science and Technology Research Center, or TRC, at Yokohama National University, which was established in 2021 as the country's first of its kind. Computer simulations indicate that if we can chill the typhoon center, which is warmer than the surrounding structure, the storm will weaken. That's a mechanism everybody understands, but how to do that is a very difficult question. Under the plan, drone fleets would swarm a typhoon from both the air and the seas, either to weaken it or draw power from it. The scientists hope to build autonomous aerial vehicles that could inject massive quantities of dry ice or other cooling materials into the storm to alter its temperature and structure. In a parallel effort, drone sailboats would capture the wind's immense energy and later transport it ashore. Fudayasu is aware of just how far-fetched this goal seems. That's why it's named Typhoon Shot, after the U.S.'s so-called Moonshot. In an accomplishment that seemed impossible at the time, NASA's Apollo program managed to put men on the moon in 1969. But Fudayasu has nevertheless convinced the Japanese government, which selected the program as one of the Cabinet Office's ambitious science initiatives aimed at benefiting the country's people and the environment. Japan aspires to be a society safe from the threat of extreme winds and rains by controlling and modifying the weather by 2050, according to the Japan Cabinet Office. In addition to combating the threat posed by typhoons, Japan is also working to reassert itself as a global leader in science and engineering. Compared to the rest of the world, the nation's share of publications in natural science journals has declined in recent years, and its government is keen to support researchers with particularly lofty ideas. The team's early plan to control typhoons involves dumping a yet-to-be-determined material with a cooling effect into the air. To compound that challenge, such a material must be harmless to the environment. Dry ice, the solid form of carbon dioxide, CO2, is one candidate. It could, in theory, cool down key parts of the typhoon. With dry ice, crystals of CO2 would act as nuclei for tiny, supercooled water droplets to freeze around, forming clouds. Ultimately, this process disperses a vast store of energy that would normally contribute to storm damage. It may sound strange, but a typhoon is very delicate and sensitive to changes in its environment and structure, says Kazuhisa Tsuboki, a professor at Nagoya University's Institute for Space Earth Environmental Research, or ICE. A tiny difference can change the storm's intensity or track, so identifying a highly sensitive point in the typhoon and modifying it could do the trick. But this process could take 3 decades to bring to fruition, Tsuboki says. Computer simulations, however, can help. These models will guide research into what materials and how much of them will be most effective, along with where they should be deployed. The team hopes to use the supercomputer Fugaku, which earned the highest ranked spot on the top 500 list of fastest computer systems in 2020 and 2021, to advance the project. Completed in 2020 by the state-backed research center Riken and IT company Fujitsu, the system can perform 442 quadrillion calculations per second. More computer power will give us more ideas and more room for testing different ideas, says Typhoon Shot member Masaki Sato, a professor at the University of Tokyo's Atmosphere and Ocean Research Institute, and a weather simulation research leader at Fugaku. It's unclear precisely how much computer power is needed to battle a super typhoon, but Tsuboki has both theoretical and direct experience to help answer that question. As head of the Typhoon Observation Lab at the TRC, Tsuboki has equipped some of the world's most powerful computers to model typhoon behavior. He fondly recalls seeing the first high-resolution modeling results on the Earth simulator, the fastest supercomputer system in the world between 2002 and 2004. When Tsuboki saw the typhoon's individual clouds materialized, the feeling was very similar to when Galileo saw Jupiter with his own telescope, or Pasteur seeing bacteria through his microscope, he says. It felt like seeing a very different world. Tsuboki also indulges his passion for exploration outside of computer simulations. As an adventurous scientist who isn't afraid of taking risks, he's flown into typhoons numerous times to take direct readings of their strength. On his first such flight, in 2017, a modified Grumman Gulfstream II jet penetrated Super Typhoon Lan, which reached wind speeds of 105 miles per hour. Tsuboki entered the storm at 43,000 feet. He wasn't even wearing a seatbelt. He was busy walking around the cabin to launch the dropsondes, airborne sensors dropped from aircraft that take readings of pressure and other crucial measurements. These sensors, about the size of a football, relay data to the craft before they hit the ocean. Their flight can take as long as 15 minutes. As air density increases at lower altitudes, they slow down. Tsuboki insists on direct observation of storms because the computer models typically used to predict their behavior are rough estimates at best. For instance, one day the dropsonde data, taken from the middle of Typhoon Lan, indicated its central pressure was increasing, but suggesting the storm was weakening. But on the same day, the Japan Meteorological Agency confirmed via satellite images that Lan was intensifying. Overall, says Tsuboki, both observations and simulations are key to understanding and eventually modifying typhoons. Typhoon control has never been attempted before, but efforts to rein in storms are nothing new. In fact, hurricanes were the target of two post-World War II U.S. government weather mitigation projects. Called Cirrus and Storm Fury, these ventures employed a method of weather modification called cloud seeding, the act of sowing clouds with small particles to alter their structure. Ultimately, both proved unsuccessful and drew criticism. Observational evidence indicates that seeding hurricanes would be ineffective because they contain too little supercooled water and too much natural ice, wrote hurricane researcher Hugh Willoughby and colleagues in a 1985 paper published in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. That's because such efforts would require plenty of supercooled water to build an additional eye wall, which would house a hurricane's most dangerous winds and heaviest rainfall, to starve the original eye wall and weaken the storm overall. Still, recent innovations, like increasingly sophisticated computer simulations and sensing systems, have made cooling typhoons far more plausible, says Yue-An Liu, head of the Hydrology Remote Sensing Laboratory at Taiwan's National Central University, although he remains skeptical of the cloud seeding approach. Liu, who is not involved in Typhoon Shot, has co-authored several articles on typhoon behavior in the Northwest Pacific, as well as on remote sensing systems to improve typhoon forecasting. After Typhoon Morakot hammered Taiwan in 2009, leaving over 600 people dead and over $14 billion in damages, Liu proposed a conceptual typhoon defense strategy. If deep, cool seawater can be pumped to the surface to reduce favorable conditions for a typhoon along its path or origin nearby, the storm's strength may be reduced. This technique could even prevent it from forming. It's well known that the temperature of the sea surface affects the intensity of typhoons, says Liu. Human interference with typhoons doesn't come without consequences, though. For one, it could disrupt nature's own balancing systems, Liu cautions. Typhoons also offer some value, he adds, pointing to how they stir up nutrients from deeper layers to the sea's surface to benefit marine species and fishing industries. They also alleviate droughts. Another skeptic is Tom DeFelice, a research associate at the University of Colorado Boulder and former president of the Weather Modification Association, a Utah nonprofit that advocates for cloud seeding. He has long studied the history of weather modification, including Project Storm Fury. While simulations may suggest controlling typhoons in such a way is feasible, DeFelice says the reality is far more complicated. The project's conceptual video implies seeding could destroy the typhoon, says DeFelice. This is far from reality, and it shows no scientific savviness, nor knowledge of using the science to accomplish such an aim. It's currently impossible to wipe out a storm completely, he notes, although Project Storm Fury suggested that cloud seeding can reduce rotational wind speeds by around 10 to 30%. DeFelice does think some of Typhoon Shot's aims could be possible eventually. Cloud seeding technologies can work to redistribute precipitation from storms to reduce harm to human populations and mitigate droughts. They could also reduce wind destruction. Yet this is unlikely to happen before the 2080s, at very optimistic estimates, DeFelice says, due to a lack of research funding and the limitations of today's cloud seeding methods. For Willoughby, now a professor of meteorology at Florida International University, current technology won't be enough to realize Typhoon Shot's bold ambitions. It's a mid-20th century idea dressed up with 21st century gizmos, drones, supercomputers, etc., he says. What's more, cloud seeding mimics what nature can already achieve. Tropical cyclones that are strong enough to merit modification, with winds exceeding 164 feet per second, can naturally form a new eye wall around the original one, a process that generally causes storms to weaken. The impacts of natural forces are therefore indistinguishable from the expected results of seeding. In fact, cloud seeding may even worsen the damage from storm surge and freshwater flooding, says Willoughby. Absent some new discovery, reviving Storm Fury doesn't seem promising, he adds. Critics aside, it's easy to see why Typhoon Shot's other wild aspiration, exploiting the storm's massive energy stores, is so tempting. Over its life cycle, the average hurricane can release the equivalent of 10,000 nuclear bombs worth of energy, according to NASA. In terms of total kinetic energy, it can release 1.3 times 10 to the 17th joules per day, about half of the global electricity generation capacity. And when it comes to rating cloud formation, a hurricane can produce 5.2 times 10 to the 19th power joules per day, some 200 times the global capacity, according to an analysis by Chris Lancey of the U.S. National Hurricane Center. In short, a staggering amount of natural, free energy emerges every year when about 85 tropical storms arrive from warm oceans. Around 45 of those grow into typhoons, hurricanes, or tropical cyclones. But could all that raw power really be harnessed? Typhoon Shot member Yutaka Terao, an emeritus professor at Tokai University's School of Marine Science and Technology, has spent more than a decade researching how ships could draw energy from typhoons. In a 2007 paper presented at the Second International Conference on Marine Research and Transportation, he outlined how a fleet of 1,000 typhoon ships could supply all of Japan's annual power needs, all without emitting CO2. The Typhoon Shot team took up Terao's idea and discussed it with researchers in a range of fields who were interested in the initiative, says Futayasu. One might imagine that the typhoon-targeting ships would be equipped with wind turbines to generate electricity, but that would make them inherently unstable and cause them to capsize, says Mitsuyuki, the Yokohama National University engineer. Instead, the ships may run on technology that's decidedly ancient, sails and screw propellers. If built, each ship would have an onboard storage battery, autonomous and remote navigation, and the ability to return to land and offload the captured energy. Assuming 20 typhoons occur near Japan annually, each typhoon generator ship with a large screw propeller could theoretically generate enough energy to power more than 30,000 average-sized American homes. However, these are simple estimates and will vary greatly depending on the design and operation of the vessel, so further study is needed, says Mitsuyuki. We think that a lot of Typhoon power generation ships should be launched to make this a viable business. For DeFelice, the plan still raises major doubts. The project's backers should be aware of the high cost and low chance of success, he warns. Even if a ship could be engineered to brave brutal wind, ocean waves, and an entire hurricane, plenty of obstacles remain. For one, the project is currently confined to computer screens. Typhoon Shot's first target is achieving higher resolution simulations, a necessary step before the team can attempt to rein in storms, team member Masaki Satao says. Moving forward, the scientists have their eyes on the long game, and Japan's Cabinet Office and the Japan Science and Technology Agency are fully backing the project, having appointed Furuyasu as project manager in April. Despite weather modifications, stormy history, and various skeptics, the team remains convinced that they can mitigate the typhoon threat amid rising sea surface temperatures and intensifying storms. I want a future in which typhoons no longer kill people, says Tsuboki. Typhoon control or modification is like a dream of science fiction, but it's not impossible. Musical mutations. Some researchers think that evolution drives transformations in both species and songs. What does Beethoven's Fifth Symphony have in common with a finch's beak? Kendrick Lamar's cadence with an elephant's trunk? They're all products of evolution, according to the theory that culture changes over time to ensure its survival, just as living organisms do. By the time Charles Darwin published his treatise on natural selection, On the Origin of Species, in 1859, scholars were wondering if comparable theories could explain the development of everything from art and religious beliefs to technology and social institutions. Darwin even noted a curious parallel between the formation of new species and of new languages. In the late 19th century, such thinking became entwined with the racist notion that culture inevitably progresses from an inferior primitive state to the superior Western civilization. Pioneering anthropologists like Edward B. Tyler and Lewis Henry Morgan applied such thinking to indigenous societies around the world with a diversity of traditions. In response to this ethnocentrism, mainstream social scientists abandoned cultural evolution as pseudoscience for the better part of a century. Only in the 1970s and 80s did a new generation of academics begin to formulate a comprehensive theory of cultural evolution, attempting to move away from the old Eurocentric baggage. They borrowed ideas and methods from biology to explain how selective environmental pressures can shape the culture. Some researchers think an evolutionary perspective could help explain the innovations that make us human. Music, as a universal human activity, offers a particularly promising avenue of investigation. As with biology, studying music from an evolutionary standpoint allows scientists to compare seemingly disparate things, ants and lions in one case, West African drumming and European ballads in the other, and uncover the laws that apply to them all. According to this framework, every lineage, whether cultural or genetic, has a shape, tree-like, web-like, or some combination. Genetic evolution is best described as a tree, with diverging branches that trace the pedigree of each organism to its ancestors, a process of inheritance called vertical transmission. Cultural inheritance is messier because it can occur horizontally and form a web in which influence can be done not only by our forebears, but also by distinct yet simultaneous lineages like genres. And genres commonly mingle. As a recent example, rapper Lil Nas X's Old Town Road incorporated Western motifs from country music, along with hints of hip-hop influences such as Nicki Minaj and Drake, though both styles have roots in African and African-American traditions. As it turns out, both vertical and horizontal inheritance can be tracked across genres. A November 2021 Evolution and Human Behavior study mapped collaborations between a global sample of electronic artists between 1975 and 1999. The resulting data set reveals how people interact and reproduce music by launching new and divergent varieties. A clear path of tree-like descent runs through the subgenres. Disco led to synth pop, And on to house music and trans music, say authors Mason Youngblood, Patrick Savage, and Kareem Barghith. Cultural evolution also explains similarities in the way that musical traditions change over time, even though separated by thousands of miles and years. Recurring melodies in Japanese and English folk music have followed similar patterns of evolution over the centuries, as Savage and colleagues reported in a March Current Biology study. In both genres, notes with important rhythmic functions were less likely to change over time as melodies shifted, and notes that did change tended to shift to neighboring frequencies. G becomes F or A, but seldom C. Musical change seems to follow certain rules, in the same vein as DNA replication. Melodies and genes both consist of sequences, notes in one case and nucleotides in the other, that are often copied from one generation to the next, with a handful of adjustments or mutations. The melody in Simon and Garfunkel's 1966 recording of the folk tune Scarborough Fair, for example, sounds similar to Martin Carthy's 1965 version, but the duo made some noticeable tweaks. In fact, Savage, a musicologist at Japan's Keio University, employed the same sequence alignment techniques that molecular geneticists use to arrange DNA when seeking similarities between sections. Though the comparison isn't perfect, he says, if you wanted to find a cultural system that was analogous to a gene, I think a melody is about as close as we can get. What sparks these transformations? Change in species arises from random genetic mutations, some of which grow common in a population thanks to natural selection. Meanwhile, cultural evolution likely involves a dizzying array of mechanisms. Some researchers have proposed that cultural inheritance stems primarily from our tendency to choose role models whom we associate with prestige and conformity. We imitate people we perceive as successful, e.g. the budding guitarist who idolizes Jimi Hendrix, or we simply follow the crowd. Others suggest that cultural outcomes are constrained by a wide range of cognitive, physical, and environmental limitations. For example, people gravitate towards a limited range of music because we evolved to process sound in similar ways. This might explain why comparable musical scales appear in separate, far-flung societies. We aren't completely at the mercy of our biology, though. The artist's creativity and the radio DJ's aesthetic leaning both drive musical development, and consumers also seem to play a formative role. In 2012, Robert McCullum, a biologist at Imperial College London, used an algorithm to turn random noise into pleasing sounds based on listeners' preferences. Nearly 7,000 people rated tens of thousands of short sound loops, and their favorites were continuously selected to pair and combine. Ultimately, the daughter loops inherited random qualities from both parents, spawning a diverse and increasingly euphonious population. From electronic clamor, McCullum and his colleagues write, a simple Darwinian process can produce music. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.